Next, from Springfield, at the annual conference of the State University's Annuitants Association, Eric Medeer, counsel to Senate President John Cullerton, talked about the legal issues involved in cutting pension benefits for current state workers and whether, in his view, such cuts would be constitutional. This runs about 35 minutes.
Good afternoon. Recently, our nation observed the 67th anniversary of the D-Day invasion of World War II. Now, in my view, I think there's another event from 1944 that bears upon our uncertain economic times and the pension issue that we are going to discuss today. In January 1944, President Roosevelt addressed the nation in what later became known as his Economic Bill of Rights speech. He put it simply, freedom from fear is eternally linked with freedom from want. FDR explained that this nation had its beginnings and grew to its present strength under the protection of certain inalienable political rights. Among them, the right to free speech, free press, free worship, and free from unreasonable searches and seizures. They were our rights to life and liberty. But FDR observed, however, that our nation has grown as it has grown. These political rights proved to be inadequate to assure that equality is here for us so we can each pursue happiness. FDR correctly explained, we have come to the clear realization of the fact that true individual freedom cannot exist without economic security and independence. Necessitous men are not free men. People who are hungry and out of a job are the stuff of which dictatorships are made. President Roosevelt continued, these economic truths called for a second Bill of Rights, under which a new basis of security and prosperity can be established, regardless of one's status, creed, or race. These economic rights include the right to a useful and gainful job, the right to earn enough to provide adequate food, clothing, and recreation, the right of every family to a decent home, the right to adequate medical care, and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health. Of course, the right to an education, and most relevant here, the right to adequate protection from the economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, and unemployment. All of these rights, Roosevelt stressed, spelled security. And unless there is security here at home, there cannot be lasting peace in the world. The Illinois Constitution's pension clause embodies the very economic security that FDR spoke of, and it absolutely protects your pension benefit rights. This conclusion is based on 8 months of researching the clause's history and reviewing relevant court decisions, interpreting the clause, all of which you can read in my wonderful article. Now, some of you may have had the chance to read the article, and you know it is quite long, so I would make one suggestion before you embark upon that path. You might want to have at least one big pot of coffee. And you may also decide that's not enough. You need to get one of those five energy drinks that they sell on TV. Now, you know, in all seriousness, there has been much debate over the protective scope of the pension clause. And in times like this, it's really important when folks are feeling insecure to understand why the clause was included in the Constitution in the first place and understand what it actually protects. At the same time, it's also important that we debunk the false claims made by some about what the pension clause means, especially those made by the Commercial Club of Chicago and its law firm of Sidley and Austin. Finally, it's imperative that we discuss potential avenues to put our pension system on a sound economic footing. These are the points I'd like to discuss today. So first, why was the pension clause included in the 1970 Constitution? Really, there are two reasons. First, public employees, especially university employees, believed in 1970 that their pension benefits were imperiled because of the fact that the legislature had consistently failed to fund the pension system. Edward Gabala, who some of you may be familiar with, he was the executive director of SURS, he explained it best in a July 1970 letter to Henry Green, who was one of the chief sponsors of the pension clause at the convention. Gabala stated that while the General Assembly has done an excellent job funding its own retirement system obligations, it has failed to meet the commitments to other public employees, and it has created such a staggering liability for future taxpayers that the extra load during an adverse economic period may require the public to renege on its obligations to public servants. Indeed, at the time of the Constitutional Convention in 1970, our five state pension systems were no better funded than they are today. In 1970, these systems were funded at 41%, and today they're hovering around 39%. The second reason the clause was included was mainly legal, to change the law. Prior to the clause's adoption, Illinois courts treated most public pensions as a gift from the General Assembly that could be changed or revoked at any time. As the Illinois Supreme Court put it in 1952, a person only had the right to share in a pension fund in the manner and on such terms as the legislature may from time to time determine best serves the welfare of the participants and the people of the state of Illinois. Of course, judges and legislators at the time enjoyed constitutional protection for their pension benefits. Now, to ensure constitutional protection, public employees lobbied the constitutional delegates for a provision that would do two things. First, safeguard pension rights based on the rights that were in place when you joined the pension system. Second, require the General Assembly to continuously fund the pension system on an actuarially sound basis. Ultimately, delegates agreed with public employees that constitutional protection for pension benefits needed to begin when a person entered the system. And that's why we modeled our pension clause off of what the New York Constitution contains in it. They had the same problem in New York in 1938, and they put that in their constitution to address the problem because there was a lot of interest in 1938 for the state to get out of funding pensions. The convention delegates, however, could not, and they did not, put a provision in there that required the General Assembly to continuously fund the pension system on a sound basis. Indeed, again, Edward Gabala of SURS largely deserves the credit for convincing the clause's sponsors to model it after the New York Constitution. So that brings us to, well, what does the pension clause protect? Simply put, the pension clause bars the General Assembly from unilaterally reducing the pension benefit rights of current employees as well as retirees. The clause does this by safeguarding the pension benefits contained in the Illinois Pension Code as of when a person joins a pension system. This also would include, of course, the employee contribution rates that are in place in the code when you join. So, for example, if the pension code states that you'll receive 50% of your final salary after 30 years of service and contributing 5% of your salary, then that is what is constitutionally guaranteed. The clause specifically provides that pension benefit rights shall not be diminished or impaired. While the clause does not require the state to fund the pension system at a particular funding ratio, it does mandate that pensions be paid when they become due. Let me repeat that. The pension clause requires and guarantees the payment of pension benefits even if a pension system goes bankrupt. Finally, the clause bars the General Assembly from unilaterally reducing pension benefits. While it bars that, these rights are contractual in nature. So what that means is that the General Assembly, assuming it can get agreement from public employees, it can change those benefits. But like any other contract, there has to be an exchange of something of value, and there has to be an ability to accept or reject the offer. So in sum, Illinois cannot simply welch on its pension promises to public servants. The law is clear on this point, and after looking at this exhaustively, and in fact, my wife, in this eight-month endeavor, she referred to this as my mistress, so I wasn't quite sure what she meant by that. But I think it's important that we also debunk some of the claims that have been made about the pension clause. Our good friends at the Commercial Club of Chicago and its law firm, Sidley & Austin, would want you to believe three things about the pension clause, none of which are true. The first fallacy is that the pension clause only safeguards the pension benefit rights a person earns through past service, and that the General Assembly can somehow reduce the pension benefits of current employees that they would need to earn through future service. That's simply not the case. The statement is completely incorrect because nowhere in the pension clause, unlike the Michigan Constitution or the Hawaii Constitution, does it contain the word earn or accrue. It simply protects benefits and that those benefits shall not be impaired or diminished. Moreover, the statement simply cannot be squared with the description that the drafters gave to what the pension clause did during the convention to the other delegates who ended up voting on it, nor can it be squared with what the voters understood about the pension clause when they ratified it. And finally, Illinois court decisions are replete with rejecting this proposition. In fact, just 3 years ago, the Illinois Appellate Court stated that pension rights vest under the clause when a person enters the pension system or when the 1970 Constitution became effective in 1971, whichever is later. So the second fallacy is this, that even if the pension clause somehow protects pension benefit rights in place when you join the system, the General Assembly nonetheless has the power to go ahead and cut benefits should there be an economic crisis that also threatens the stability of the pension system itself. This statement was weighed, it was measured, and it was found wanting during the Constitutional Convention. And here's how. Before the convention adjourned in September 1970, the Pension Laws Commission, whose job it was to recommend to the General Assembly the impact of proposed legislation affecting pensions, as well as monitoring what was going on at the Constitutional Convention. Before the Constitutional Convention adjourned, the Pension Laws Commission asked Henry Green, the sponsor of the pension clause, on two different occasions, if he would entertain an amendment to specifically give the legislature the power to cut benefits in such a circumstance. Both requests were denied. And since that time, Illinois courts have observed this fact, and they have held that the General Assembly lacks this type of power to come in and make such a change. Here's some facts that we should all be aware of. Between 1985 and 2007, before the 2008 stock market crash, our state's pension system liabilities grew by $33 billion. Over 70% of that growth came from the fact that the General Assembly had not paid the pension payments it was required to pay. Since 2007, the state's unfunded liabilities have grown by almost $35 billion. 53% of that growth did come from the stock market crash, but 26% of that growth, the second cause of that growth, was due to the fact that, again, the state did not pay its share. So, in short, this argument that's being established here by our friends with the Commercial Club and Sidley and Austin is that this crisis, which has been primarily created, is a valid excuse in which to abscond on their promises to pension recipients. Typically, that type of argument doesn't have much play in the court of law. The final fallacy is that the pension recipient is only entitled to receive the pension benefit, pension payments if there is money in a pension fund. So if a pension fund goes broke, you're out of luck. Now, again, there are statements in the explanation of the Constitutional Convention, at the Constitutional Convention, by the sponsors that they were cognizant of this, and they intended for pension payments to be an absolute obligation of the state, and that people would receive their payments when they become due. And the Illinois Supreme Court has recognized that. And they did so within the last 15 years. So this brings us to the last part. How do we try to resolve this? Our state's unfunded pension obligations now total over $80 billion. But like with anything else, it's a long-term problem that requires a long-term solution. The Commercial Club's recent proposal contained in Senate Bill 512 is not the answer. As Steve Zahn will discuss in a little bit, the club's plan would require current employees to pay higher contribution rates that are cost prohibitive simply to keep the same level of benefits they have today. These higher contributions are intended to drive people out of the current pension system and therefore have a collapse on itself. And just think of it this way. Think of having a 30-year mortgage and your bank says, got a great offer for you now. Instead of paying that $1,000 a month, why don't you pay me $2,000? And you know what? I'm not going to put a cap on it. It'll just keep going up in order for you to keep your house and keep everything you still have. I don't know how many people would take that offer, but but that's essentially what was being offered. Now, frankly, the pension system needs consistent funding, and that means new revenue. Yes, the General Assembly passed the income tax increase that has been mentioned here, and yes, for the first time in several years, we've made the full pension payment that's been required without borrowing. But more money is needed in order for the system to become more sound, and it seems that a tax increase perhaps would seem unlikely. So, you know, not only it's not to be ruled out, but there's other avenues that probably would also need to be explored. So in my view, any solution is going to require some form of self-sacrifice, shared and self-sacrifice by folks. And as mentioned, the pension rights guaranteed by the clause are contractual in nature. So the General Assembly cannot simply cut its way unilaterally to resolve the crisis, but it can try and offer public employees something of real value to incentivize them to want to participate in that type of a solution. So the General Assembly, one perhaps avenue here is that they could offer public employees a binding commitment to follow the current pension funding schedule that's in state law as an enforceable obligation. This would mean that the General Assembly could no longer take pension holidays as it has amassed. Rather, the General Assembly would be subject to a binding commitment to fund the state's five pension systems at the existing 90% rate by 2045. And again, as a binding commitment, unlike previous attempts, this could be a commitment that can be enforced in court, much like a bond repayment schedule that bondholders would have. In exchange, public employees could be asked to contribute perhaps a 3% increase more of their salary to their respective pension systems. This is just one notion. There could be other attempts at a revenue source. But the important point is this: whatever the increase is that's coming through a form of a shared sacrifice, that amount of money should be utilized solely to pay unfunded pension liabilities. The payment, in turn, would help to level the state's payments to the system on a long-term basis, and therefore make the problem that we have today manageable. Now, the proposal is not a quick fix, but it could make it manageable, and clearly there needs to be a lot more thought and a lot more input from stakeholders such as yourselves. But for the proposal to work, public employees must agree that shared sacrifice is necessary and have faith that the state is going to meet its end of the bargain. So I've covered a lot of ground here, and I'm very interested in the questions that you might have. So let me just conclude with the following. The claims made by the Commercial Club and Sidley and Austin about the pension clause have no merit. The clause protects the pension rights in place when a person joins a pension system. And finally, the clause also guarantees that a person will receive the pension payments when those payments become due, regardless of the funding status of the particular pension fund. Thanks for your time. Thank you for the opportunity. Sir, what's your name?
I have two questions with regard to the hypothetical contract negotiations. One is, to negotiate, you need two parties. On the one
sure.
side, you've got the General Assembly. On the other side, who do we have? We have a motley crew of employees. Okay, that's the first question.
Sure.
The second question, you said something about the insurance could bind themselves to make the actuarial required contributions. How can this year's General Assembly, by future General
Assembly,
sure.
Pay that out? Let me take them in reverse order. So his second question was, how can the legislature mandate to future legislatures to make a binding commitment along a funding schedule? We do it today. We did the capital bonds, and we're going to be paying those bonds the next 30 years. When you enter into a contract, that type of contract avoids the very principle of law that you're mentioning, which is that a future legislature cannot bind, one legislature cannot bind future legislatures. We are bound right now that we cannot impair it because it's a contract. All we would need to do is make the language specific enough that the schedule itself is deemed to be a benefit. And it would also be wrapped as a contractual right, and it would be something that we could not impair or diminish going forward. And the second, to address your other question, how does the negotiation work? Well, there's two components to that. In my view, you have first employees that are in the unions, and you have employees that are non-union. There's some question, and again, we have based our pension clause off of what they've done in New York, to what extent the existing collective bargaining laws that we have, the Public Labor Relations Act, would permit the union staffs to bargain on behalf of their members to try and come up with some type of negotiation. And since the critical mass of public employees are in unions, that could provide an avenue to get that agreement and to have that negotiation take place. But when it comes to non-union employees, including myself, you're still going to have to deal with the problem with individual agreement and acceptance. And that is an issue that has to be studied to be overcome.
One thing, your announcement of the capital markets as well. The capital markets have a very heavy sanction they can impose if the state defaults. denying them access to capital markets. That's a big sanction. We don't have that sanction.
Well, if the contractual obligation requires that the payments be made, and we've already seen this happen with the judges who are entitled to get their cost of living adjustment, that you would be able to have a cause of act to go into court and get the checks cut from the comptroller. And that's what happened with the judges and their cost of living. The judges said, yeah, there might have not have been an appropriation from the General Assembly for us to be paid our COLA, but you're in violation of law. You're in violation of a constitutional obligation. That's enough authority for the court to issue an order to mandate that the comptroller cut a check.
So you eliminate the assembly altogether?
Well, it depends on what the deal would be, but if that's what the agreement would be, you have the funding schedule as a binding commitment, just like any other repayment schedule that you'd have for bondholders.
All pensions are individual contracts. Am I not correct that the individual can negotiate their or renegotiate their contract?
Sure. Yeah. But you have to understand who has the authority on the other end. Does the other end have the authority to agree?
I understand that.
Yeah.
Still has to be a negotiation.
That's correct.
I have two questions. One is, one concern that has been expressed in various quarters is the possibility of an amendment to the impairment clause of the Constitution. My question was, would federal contract law still cover that for everybody under that Constitution when they were employed?
Even though the legislature can still pursue perhaps a constitutional amendment, you still would then come full circle and have to deal with the federal contracts clause. Yes.
So that would protect it?
Correct. In fact, to give you an example, in Oregon, the state of Oregon, they had a circumstance where the public employees, their contribution rate was 6% of their salary. And they ended up passing a state statute down the road that said the state will, in fact, pay that 6% on behalf of the employee. Much like a lot of states out, they have these initiatives. And so they had a constitutional initiative that was passed to say that no longer would the state pick up the employee's 6%. And that was challenged by the police union out there, and they were successful in getting that constitutional amendment thrown out as violating the federal contracts clause.
Second question. In your legal opinion, there are two places where you hint that the impairment clause also protects benefits that are in place at the time that employment begins.
Yes.
And that implies health insurance benefits.
Well, I'll be completely frank. I have not studied the issue of how of the intersection of the pension clause with health care. But let me point out a couple things. The way that our pension clause and the way the case law shakes out on this is that you need to look to what's contained in the Illinois Pension Code as your basis of rights. It's my understanding that the health care aspect is not contained anywhere in the pension code. It's in a separate statute, although I believe that they use the operative definitions of who's an annuitant as a way to understand who's covered through the health care part of it. And I bring this up because in New York, they actually, and again, our provision is based off the New York Constitution, they actually litigated this issue. They had the same exact setup that we have in terms of health care wasn't mentioned in the pension provisions, but health care was mentioned elsewhere, but there was this incorporation by reference. And the New York courts said that two things. One, they were only looking at pensions. They're only worried about pensions. They weren't talking about health care at all. And two, since health care is not mentioned in the pension statutes, that took it outside of the scope. You know, obviously, the history of our clause is that there was no mention of health care. You know, I don't believe the healthcare stance came about until about 1971. So, on the other hand, Hawaii most recently took this issue up in April of 2010, and they came to a different view. And it was really based it had similar facts as to what was going on in New York.
You're talking about negotiations on both sides, but that one enters into negotiations having good faith and trust in your negotiating partner. What would inspire us or give us some faith to trust the state in these negotiations? Because they haven't met their obligation for how many years.
I don't have an answer for you. I don't know.
But perhaps you can bring that back to the other side in terms of, I understand a reasonable, logical, rational, I think, person. And I understand the crisis, and something will have to change. But the obligation hasn't been met, and you're telling me the only way you see is to double what I have to contribute. That's not even the meaning.
I don't think that's the only way. That was just one potential aspect. If we're talking about this along the lines of a shared sacrifice. Because I think this issue is out there, and it's so prominent, and it's going to continue to stay there. Because I think individuals that were proponents of Senate Bill 512, they're not going to give up. They're not going to give up until they have something that they can demonstrate we achieved a goal. And that's a political reality. So the question is, what can there be done on the other end if we're going to speak in terms of shared sacrifice, that you can achieve something and make it binding enough that one party can't walk away, as we have had through the history of this. So. The last thing we would want is to go down the road and put the systems in jeopardy. I think everybody wants to do something about it. Nobody really wants to get to that precipice.
One thing is clarification, your kind of question comment. The clarification is, and it's been alluded to, and perhaps you explained it well enough, and I just couldn't absorb it. But for those of us already retired, it is my superficial understanding that federal contract law says that there's really, even if they change the Constitution, we are still entitled to what we have for those that are already retired. Short of, I guess, a state bankruptcy, and then that would set in a whole new set of issues. But am I correct in that assumption?
Right. There's two levels of protection. One is the pension clause itself, and of course, and because you're still a member of the system, I mean, you're an annuitant. But you would have the constitutional provision under the federal constitution.
Okay. Right. I have one follow-up on
sure.
That. Sure. On the health and that's the basis of the constitution. When I read the constitutional language, which you have put in here, it does talk not only about a pension, membership in a pension or retirement system, and it talks about the benefits of which shall not be diminished or impaired. I realize this is all very iffy, but it does seem to me that at least I've seen many court cases that go of far more spacious parties than that we would be protected or under the retiree health. Based upon this language, of which I have no idea as to how the courts would finally rule, but when they don't just mention the pension from you, they mention retirement. When you retire, do you get that? And if someone's mentioned it, you are aware that you were here. That you get a letter saying it's part of your retirement. How do you think that would play out?
Well, I agree. You can make that argument based on the plain language of the text. But based upon the current understanding, the way it's been interpreted, the four corners of the contract, if you will, is the pension code. And that pension code, at the time you entered the system, plus any enhancements that may have come along. And so since the healthcare components are not in the pension code, that's what you're running up against. Thank you for the opportunity.
You're watching the Illinois Channel, an independent nonprofit corporation formed to provide gavel-to-gavel coverage of Illinois state government and other public affairs events taking place across Illinois.